Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 55 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday to you, Larry.
Thank you, Andy, and happy Saturday to you. Final week before Christmas.
Yeah, it is. So we recorded out of schedule last week, and maybe we were on target last week, but then the week before, I'm all twisted out of whack. We already talked about the crazy winter thing. Never mind. I'm still having delusions from that drive.
Yes, we did. We spent an hour talking about weather.
and people say I'm the one that exaggerates.
Well, you are.
So speaking of North Carolina, do you have anything to report about the North Carolina that they didn't appeal?
I do. I have the time for a normal appeal for the Meredith versus Stein case that we talked about has expired. And that means to appeal at this point, we would have to be what is referred to as an out-of-time appeal. And those do happen. The prosecution or the state apparatus, and even the other side, we do it occasionally. We apply for leave to do an out-of-time appeal. But as far as the time for appeal has expired and there was no appeal filed, which means that the Meredith versus Stein decision by the federal judge in North Carolina saying that they have to provide Mr. Meredith a process to translate his out-of-state offense, it is final.
And just to backtrack a little bit.
It means that I predicted that they would appeal, and so far I was wrong.
And do we get to mark this on the calendar as being the first time?
I think it's the third, actually, but yes, you can do that.
I'm not trying to rub your nose in it. I mean, it's great that they're not appealing, but let's keep some sort of fair score and keep things honest about, hey, if you made a prediction and it was wrong, then hey, call it out as being wrong.
Well, that's the normal thing that they do because they're not going to want to provide a due process, and they argued vehemently against due process. They say the conviction is a due process. I would not say we're completely out of the woods yet because out-of-time appeals do happen. And they get great deference because they claim that they were overworked and had a tremendously heavy caseload and that it fell through the cracks and they filed for leave. But at this point, they did not file within the time limit.
And that was the case where the guy transferred from out of state and he tried to go to the office more than once and they said, no, you don't have to register. But then they caught up with him. And they said that what this ultimately means for our people is that you could have something that would land you on the registry for life in certain states. And this would give you some way to have your translation be something lower. So maybe you don't have to register for life.
Well, it means if you have an out-of-state offense and if you locate from your state of conviction to another state, and that state happens to have language that says something along the lines of equivalent offenses, reasonably substantially similar, or something that says that they have to do a translation. If they just take the position that everybody who moves here that has a registration obligation has to register here, then it's not as helpful. But for those states that have language such as North Carolina has that has to be substantially similar, then they have to have a process to determine that similarity. And they did not do that in the case of Meredith.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, and that's good for us, good for our people. I guess like in a state like Florida, where another state may have tier ones and twos not have to register or register for a short period of time. But in a state like Florida, you just register forever if you got convicted of urinating in public, right?
Well, there again, since I haven't prepared Florida, I haven't looked at what triggers a registration obligation. If they have language that says these Florida offenses are their reasonably equivalents from other jurisdictions, then it would be the same thing in Florida. You would, once it was determined that the offense was equivalent, you would still have to register in Florida. But in states where the period of registration varies, it's extremely important that they translate it correctly because it could mean a longer term on the registry. Florida, the only thing it would make is whether you're on the registry or not, if they have the language that requires that they be equivalent or similar or substantially similar. All states don't have that language. Some states just say if you have an obligation to register anywhere, you have an obligation to register here.
Right.
But it's helpful those states where the language allows for a translation of whether it's an equivalent or reasonably equivalent to one of their offenses.
All right. Well, let's chalk that up to at least some level of victory for us. And that being the hotbed of where cases are coming to light in North Carolina, which is kind of an interesting, I don't know. I find it interesting that it pretty much everything is coming out of there. They're jerks in general, like with everybody on the registry having can't use the internet. You know, we had to go fight that, where other places people have at least some degree of freedom to use the internet. So there's that case that comes out of there. It just seems a whole bunch of stuff that comes out of there, and they're thumbing their putting their thumbs in people's eyes that are on the registry.
They have a lot of restrictions that are really, really significant, and happen to have legal professionals, including Paul Dubling, one of Narsil's regular attorneys, and then Glenn Girding, who's right now with the North Carolina Public Defender's Office. They've been bringing challenges, and this case here was Paul Dubling's, but we're going to emulate it in my state. We're going to use the logic and reasoning to make the same point here, that we need a due process to determine if it's equivalent to one of ours.
And just to fill in one little piece of that puzzle, somebody has to have standing to bring a challenge, right?
That would be correct. If you have an out-of-state offense and you're living in another state that has that language, then you would have the requisite standing to say that you should be afforded some due process. And what constitutes due process is somewhat subjective. But in the case of North Carolina, the parties stipulated they didn't have any due process. It was up to the sheriff. He went to one sheriff and they told him he didn't have to register. He went to when he moved, for whatever reasons, he went and checked again with a new sheriff, which that defies all imagination of mine, but he went and they told him, no, he didn't have to register. And then some years later, they contacted him and said, actually you do. And that's what triggered the litigation,
right,
was that they had reversed themselves. Now, had he never approached the Wake County Sheriff in Raleigh, who knows? We may not be here, because he would not have possibly ever been told to register. It was him checking in and saying, I know I don't have to register. I know the sheriff in this county told me 8 years ago I don't have to register, but I just want to make sure now I'm in your county. Do I have to? I mean, like I said, that defies all logic. I would consider one determination from a sheriff to be sufficient, but
right,
apparently he won't. Second one.
The other piece of that seems kind of interesting to me is he would have moved and he became like a known entity in one county, and then he moved to a new county. That would have made him further anonymous and then not check in, and the other sheriff may have just been like, oh, well, they don't live there anymore, and move on about their day and never, ever question it again.
Well, the sheriff already told him he didn't have to register. I can't imagine they would have checked in on him again, because he didn't have to register. Why would they be checking in on him?
True.
All right. It's like, I don't understand. But I have this all the time when people do things. I have this same issue when you go to Nevada and they say you have to register in 48 hours. And I ask people, well, on the 49th hour, is there going to be a sudden release of radiation from your body? Well, no, well, Larry, you don't understand, but it's the law. But you can't even find anybody who will process you within 48 hours
right
of being in Nevada. So you're going to spend your entire 48 hours trying to get processed and not do your business that you're there for, that you need to be there for 51 hours. Right. I'm not advising you to disregard the law. I'm just telling you that on the 48th hour, the first minute after that, there's not going to be a sudden burst of radiation. The Geiger counters are not going to zero in on you.
We would have to go to a movie called Minority Report, which I'm pretty sure you haven't seen, where they catch you of a crime before you've committed it, and they come in and arrest you an hour or day before the crime. They have these little, like, seer things, whatever, not to get into the whole thing. But I've considered this, like, you're barreling down the interstate. You're going 100 miles an hour down the interstate, and you do it for 10 seconds between two exits, and then you stop doing it. You're guilty of doing something wrong, but if nobody caught you, there are no consequences for it necessarily. And this is kind of the same thing. If you stay out of their way, and again, not suggesting anybody does this, but like, chill out. If nobody knows that you're doing, if you're there, if no one knows that you're doing something wrong, then no one's going to know you're doing anything wrong, and let it go and don't stress over it.
And it gets very complicated. People will write emails and say, I don't understand. Actually, I do understand.
Yeah.
There are states where it says if you're going to be out of your home territory for a certain number of days, you have to let them know. Well, there again, unless they have a continual surveillance on you that watches you 24/7, they would not know that you were gone for 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, or whatever the case is. They would not know that. But people feel obligated if they're going to be gone. If it's a 5 day window that if it says if you're going to be out of state for five or more days, you let us know. Well, I'm not telling you don't let them know, but I'm struggling to figure out how they would know.
Yeah.
If you didn't tell them,
unless they came, you know, like that, you know, that, I mean, yeah, because you could have gone to work, you could have gone out to a friend's house, you could have just spent the night at your mom's house. You weren't gone for more than that time. You just happened to not be there when they checked.
Okay, but even if you're not there with the check, unless the statute says you have to call them, there again, you're not required to be home. No one has showed me a statute that says you must be home for residency checks. So they check and you're not there, and there's no requirement that you call. I personally would not call unless the statute required me to call.
Right, because you still reside there. Like your mail still goes there. Your utilities go there. You still live there. You just aren't there for X number of days or hours.
Yes, but they intimidate people. They tell them, if you don't call us, we'll assume you've moved and we'll get a warrant. And well, that would be nice. You can get the warrant. I'm not saying that somebody can't get a warrant.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you that it would be difficult to convict a person for you don't have the proof that they have moved.
Yeah.
If you get a warrant saying that they haven't been seen, that's not the same thing as proving that they don't live there, that they live someplace else.
Right. Right.
People forget that to some degree, even though the victim's advocates would have there be no burden of proof, it still is the government's job to prove. If they're going to allege that you have established a new residence and not notified them, they have to prove that.
Right. Hey, well, let's cover some articles. This first one comes from Above the Law, and this is a female attorney who is defending a guy accused of rape. And you know, you hear rape, and right off the bat, you're like, oh, that guy's a monster for doing that. His side of the story is that he's at a club, he's 22 years old, meets some chick, and they decide that they're going to go into the bathroom and do some cocaine, and they go in there and then they have consensual sex. She claims rape. And so the premise of the story, though, is that the attorney's like, how am I supposed to defend this guy? I'm there. He deserves equal representation. But how am I sensitive to how I'm going to present the case so that he doesn't turn out to be a monster, so that I respect the accuser? It's just like she's describing that she's in a really, really tough spot. And one of the quotes that I wanted to pull out of the article is, of the remaining jurors who were not excused, when I asked the question, how many of you believe that just because a woman claims she was raped, she's telling the truth? Almost every hand went up. Reconcile that with the presumption of innocence. And I think that's the key of the article, is that right there. Shouldn't we have a presumption of innocence?
Yes, and each one of those prospective jurors should have been dismissed for cause, and the judge should have supported them. If they say that a mere accusation is enough, then they have already decided the case before any of the evidence is heard, and they should have been dropped. And the attorney should have made the motion to excuse those jurors for cause so that she didn't have to use any of her peremptory challenges. And the peremptory challenges are the ones where you don't need a reason. You can just simply look at them and say, I don't like looking the way you look. I don't need a reason. I don't want you on the jury. But you only get so many peremptory challenges. And the rest have to be for cause.
There have been some interesting Supreme Court challenges where there are all kinds of ways to excuse somebody for racial reasons, but they come up with that they didn't like the shirt they were wearing because it was a different sports team. They just come up with all kinds of ludicrous ways to say, oh, I don't want black people on the jury.
It becomes more difficult for the prosecution, because if you have a minority defendant in an area where there's very few of the minority, then of the whole panel that would be the jury would be selected from, you might not have but 2 out of 100. And the prosecution can easily use their peremptory challenges to exclude any minority representation.
Right.
So I believe the case was Batson that dealt
sounds,
with that issue.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
There's a
standard on the prosecution that's slightly higher to not use those challenges, just simply to make the jury free of any minority representation.
There is a podcast called More Perfect, And they cover that issue in season two, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a podcast that is just 100% about the Supreme Court, probably something that you would actually like. And I cannot remember which one it is, which episode it is. I'm pretty sure it's out of season two because I didn't listen to season one. But anywho, yeah, they
Yes,
covered.
it's Batson versus Kentucky, 1986.
Okay.
I just searched it.
The episode of More Perfect. It's really interesting. Listen, is called Object Away. And yeah, so you had it right. It's Batson, and that's the case. Which is, like I said, it's a really good episode if you want to get a deep dive into how the different sides try and exclude different jury members. But anyway, so back to this case about the woman trying to defend this guy in the era of Me Too. It really would be totally like dancing on eggshells.
It would be for a particular for a woman attorney,
Right?
because they would be viewed as selling out. I mean, oh, you've done gone over the other side. But my it's easy for me to say, of course, since I'm not female. But my job is to be as zealous as I can, and to prevent the state from proving this beyond a reasonable doubt. I am not here to help you get justice. I am here to make sure that my side gets the best representation possible. This is a dueling contest. We're not trying to get to the truth. And people misunderstand that about our system. We are not trying to find out the truth at a trial. I mean, if the truth comes out, that's fine. But it's a dual contest between two parties and a referee. And I'm going to do everything I can within the rules to make sure that you don't win. That's the bottom line. That's what I do as a defense attorney. And so I'm going to use every tool within the arsenal, within ethics, to make sure that you don't prevail.
Just clarify one thing. You just said a defense attorney. I know that you're on the
I said, if
defense
I am a
side.
defense
Oh,
attorney,
if you are. Okay. I just
yes,
want.
I'm on,
Okay.
yeah, if I, yes, if I, and so on the defense side, we are going to do everything we can
Right.
to make sure that you don't prevail. Our job is not to help the state convict guilty people.
Right. Right.
And
Yeah.
somehow that has been twisted and distorted, that the defense attorney and the prosecution are somehow supposed to work hand in hand and sing kumbaya and try to figure out a good outcome. That is a possibility if your client is guilty and you're looking for a reasonable outcome.
Some plea
But
bargain.
if there's any doubt, if the client says, "I didn't do it," it's not our job to help you get a conviction. Our job is to make damn sure you don't.
Yeah, again,
So,
it's not about if somebody's lying, if someone did it, if they didn't do it. It's about who can prove their side. It's a debate.
well, and just in case people forget, the accusing party bears the burden,
Right.
not the accused. And the burden is a very high one in a criminal proceeding. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, there might be significant evidence, even evidence that would convict a person in a civil proceeding, but it's not enough in a criminal proceeding where the standard is so high. It is supposed to be hard to put people in cages.
You would
That's the way the
think,
founding fathers intended it.
but as we heard Lindsey Graham say, we have 8 times more people incarcerated than most other Western nations. So it seems like we haven't made it hard to put them in cages. We have actually made a pretty efficient system to do it.
We have through the process of making everything criminal and making the sentences so long for criminal conduct, the cages would not be as full if we weren't keeping people in them for so long. We could still have a lot of people go into cages,
Yeah.
but we're putting people in them for many times longer than the rest of the world does, the Western world, that is.
Yeah.
But it's supposed to be difficult to put people in a cage. If you don't like that, then you need to change the Constitution, or let's get rid of the presumption of innocence, or let's get rid of all these inconvenient things like due process and confrontation clause and all that. If it's inconvenient to be confronted when you make an accusation trying to put someone in a cage, then let's do away with that. But in the meantime, this is the system we have, and we're supposed to have a hard time putting person away. That's the way it was designed.
That one's interesting. That is it'd be interesting to revisit this one and see how that attorney deals with it, see how various these various cases come about. Because I mean the guy isn't even claiming in this particular case, he's not even claiming like complete innocence. He's just claiming he didn't rape her. And
He's saying it was consensual.
right, and the accuser says when she left the bathroom, she told her friend, "I think I was raped." What does that mean? I don't want to badmouth the accuser. I'm baffled at, like, so you went along with it, but after the fact you feel squishy about it? What is the guy supposed to do if you feel problematic about it after the fact?
Well, that's sometimes referred to as buyer's remorse,
I'll take
and
that, sure.
I can imagine that when people's minds are altered, and that's what was happening here, that's what the evidence shows, right? That their minds were being altered by the
Well,
drugs.
I'm not sh I mean, that seems like, coke hits you pretty fast if you snort it, I guess. I'm not really sure if they did that. She did two
Well, I'm
bumps of
assuming.
cocaine.
Well, then I don't know what any of that means because
Me
I've never
neither.
done any cocaine.
Me neither.
But I'm assuming that it's a mind altering. I can't imagine why you would do it if it didn't alter your mind.
Yeah.
If you felt the same when you finished it, why would you spend all the money and bust in houses and do things to get something, but you feel exactly the same way when you finish? That would make no sense. So I'm assuming it's a mind altering drug. Now,
Right.
that would be a good one for somebody to call in and explain this all to us so we can put it on next week because I've not never touched that stuff. I've never smoked any marijuana, and I've never been drunk and intoxicated, so I don't know all these things. I truly don't. But I'm assuming that at the end of it, if your mind is altered by the ingestion of the cocaine, that it would be easier to have buyer's remorse afterwards because your mind would clear up at some point, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And I know we sound kind of silly saying this, but I am assuming things that I don't know.
Yep, I'm with you. Well, how about let's talk about the advocate and state public defender warns Louisiana lawmakers of dire scenario if funding isn't increased. Here we go. We've talked about this before, if I'm not mistaken, about how little, I mean, we've talked about it in abstract, but I think that we've talked about it specifically in Louisiana, maybe with King, that they just have an atrocious method of funding, atrociously small method of funding the public defender's office, and they're gonna have, is this where they had, like, I just seem to remember some numbers that we talked about where there was like one attorney and 500 cases, and you're like, how are you supposed to get any justice out of that? I just remember something along those lines, but there's a lawsuit filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center that is pushing the Louisiana public defender's system that they need more money or else these people don't get, like, forget having like top-notch defense. How about any defense?
It's sad because this is chronic across the country. We just have picked on certain states. It's chronic in my state. I'm sure it's chronic in Georgia. I know we talked about Wisconsin where they were paying $40 an hour,
That's
which
what it
is a
was. Yep.
was a, it was a that's a rate that goes back decades. And the crushing caseloads. We could dramatically increase public defender resources, or we could dramatically curtail the input. See, the
Yes.
problem that the public misses on this is that of the tripod of the criminal justice system, there's the prosecution, there's the defense, and there's the court itself. Of those three legs of that stool, only one can control, only one cannot control at all their caseload, and that's the public defender. If
Okay.
you are indigent and you qualify, you get shoved down to the public defender. The prosecutor gets to choose which cases they file.
Right.
They get to choose which cases they plead out. The judge gets to decide if they want to let the prosecution have continuous after continuous, or they want to hold them to the rules and they want to start dismissing cases for failure to prosecute speedy trial. The poor defense has very little that they can do to alter the caseload trajectory. They're at the mercy of the other two components. And so if the public doesn't want to pay for defense, and I know clearly they don't, it's not popular anywhere in the country. When you go out on the campaigns making your stump speeches and you say, "I pledge to you that if I get elected, that I'm going to make a number one priority to put more money in the indigent defense so that the people that the cops arrest will have robust representation," something tells me that the votes are going to taper off dramatically.
Yeah, I have a feeling that
So
that would be true.
that's just not going to happen. But But it's kind of like at some point the courts are going to have to intervene. And I don't know where the tipping point is, because we've tried in my state here. We've tried. The public defender has said they filed motions saying that they can't provide adequate representation. And the judges are saying, well, even though your case loads are dramatically higher than the recommended standards, as far as I can see in my courtroom, y'all doing a pretty good job. Yeah. So I think you're providing just fine representation. So I think that you could up the ante. And I think I said this on the podcast earlier in our episodes, that what you could do when the judge calls the case to trial, when the judge says, parties, are you ready? The state would say, yes, Your Honor. The defense would say, well, actually, Your Honor, we are not ready.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, we talked about that.
Because my office is so seriously understaffed, I have not been able, and I just want to say for the record, I have not been able to visit with my client. I've not had one face-to-face meeting. I've only got through the first ream of discovery, and we're in no way ready to go to trial. I haven't done any witness interviews, and I have done no outside investigation on this case. So, Your Honor, to answer your question, we are not ready to go.
Right.
Now, you could do that. Now, I don't know what the ramifications would be. I don't know. I mean, the court wouldn't be happy. I can tell you that. I know before we get, the court wouldn't be happy, and the court would call a sidebar and say, what the hell do you mean you're not ready to go? This case has been around a year and a half. Why aren't we ready? What kind of pressures, external pressures, would be applied? That would be one way. The next way, when the person gets convicted, when you weren't ready, when they filed their appeal, then you could stipulate as the attorney, I did not provide, and you could give an affidavit saying, well, I didn't do this, I didn't do this, and I didn't do this, and I didn't do this. And that might force the issue. But I don't see a lot of takers willing to do those things.
Yeah, you're going to send a whole shit ton of people up the river, and you're then going to like fall down on your sword, so to speak. You're going to have a lot of people then clouding up the court system with some sort of retrial, because you had ineffective a counsel.
I would say that, but wouldn't that force the good taxpaying citizens to decide, if you can't afford to fund indigent defense, and it's a constitutional requirement, then perhaps maybe you ought to stop bringing everybody to court for everything.
But everybody's guilty of something, so we have to prosecute everybody.
Well, then you got to pony up. If you can't prioritize what's important for prosecution, then get used to paying taxes. And we need the people that are running for office to say that. You know, I don't, madam, ladies and gentlemen, I don't like here, say if it's a county level system like Georgia has, you're running for DeKalb County Commission, which is just outside Atlanta. You say, I don't like having to, I'd much rather be providing you senior citizen center. I'd like to be putting more money in our school system. I'd like to have more money in after school programs. I'd like to have these potholes repaired. I'd like to have more people so the animal control's on duty 24 hours a day. I'd like to do all these things, but we're charging everybody with crimes, and that's our constitutional obligation. So we're going to put more and more money in indigent defense unless we figure out how to divert people from prison and from the justice system. So it's kind of up to us to be creative, but this is what we have to do. I mean, at some point, you might have to start saying that, and it would probably go over pretty well in DeKalb County because they're a lot more progressive over there, but it still wouldn't be a slam dunk.
How about, so if we have a city that's increasing in population and they're going to start resizing roads and figuring out where schools should go, I'm assuming that nothing along those lines happens for the court system. Shouldn't there be some sort of ratio, quota, something or another to balance that number between public defenders and the population size or the county size, something, you know, something along those lines to balance it out?
Courts tend to be the allocation for court resources tends to be a reactive thing, and schools do as well. I mean, they very seldom build schools for population expectations 15 years out.
Right.
They're usually because they have overcrowding, and they say the ideal population for this school is an elementary school. It should have more than 520 students, and we're at 790. And they say that's across our entire school district. That's the problem. But the same thing with the courts, they tend to be populations as they not only do they increase, they shift.
Right. Of course.
So you've had a migration through the last 20, 30 years from urban, from rural to urban.
Right.
And so you have smaller towns that have become smaller, and they sometimes need fewer judicial resources.
Of course.
Because the population they once had is no longer there. And so you allocating resources for the judiciary is the most difficult thing. The public defender is the most difficult thing. The law enforcement has an easier time at it because they're there in uniform regularly telling you that they're the ones keeping you safe. And you hear from them most prominently. So they're getting their share of the pie. If you look at any budget, whether it be your city, local law enforcement is the big, if you look at public safety, if you look at any county or city budget, the big bulk of it goes to public safety.
But I mean, it doesn't sound to me like it would be hard to bring in another attorney because we have, I don't know, another 100,000 people in the area to be on the public defense roster. It just, it seems like there would be a ratio of a number. Here's how many X people equals one public defender. That's got to be.
Well, there is that.
But so then they just short sell it, or they underfund it in general?
Well, they underfund it. I mean, we know the ratios of the ideal, the Bar Association. I mean, there's recommended guidelines for felony level defense and misdemeanor level defense, and there's of how many cases we know those details. But if you're in, since 2008, for example, my state has basically had frozen spending. We're spending at 2008 levels.
All right.
We reached $6 billion for our budget, which is really puny, but we're a small, poor state. We reached $6 billion in 2006 or 7 fiscal year. The economy tanked in 2008, and we backed it off to $5.4 billion because of the state has to balance its budget. We've been slowest to recover. We've had the highest unemployment rate in the nation, and we've been spending around $6.2 billion for the last 10 years. So within that 10 years of inflation, there's been all sorts of containment of spending. People who are on Medicaid waiver waiting lists, they've waited longer for services because they've only got so many slots. Positions have been frozen, so there's been hiring freezes. So the public defender may be ideally at this level of full-time equivalence, but they haven't had the funding because of the budgetary constraints. So the funding has just not been there. And for the conservatives who think that the government should always shrink, that's fine. But we have shrunk our government by attrition for the last practically decade. Now this year, because of the resurgence in energy, which we're an energy producing state, we're going to have $1 billion of new revenue. So we're anticipating that the recurring revenues are going to jump to around $7.2 billion. Well, that sounds like a lot of money, except for if you factored in an inflation factor for the last 10 years, we would be over $7 billion anyway. Yeah. And you factor in inflation as well as population growth and needs change depending on the demographics of your population. So a state that has more young people is going to have more need for K-12 education. A state that has a lot more older population is going to have a lot more need for services to deal with seniors. And there's everything is not stagnant.
Of course.
But we're spending at 2008 levels here, and now there's some new money on the horizon, and you ought to see the feeding frenzy. Of course, the Public Defender's Department has got their handout saying we've been underfunded, but so does everybody else. Every single thing that government does is says that the school districts are saying we've been starved. Right. The prosecution saying we've been starved. The judiciary has been saying we've been starved. The health department, they're saying they've been starved. I mean, it gets on and on, and there's well over $1 billion worth of requests in for budget increases. Everybody's not going to get what they're asking for.
Yeah, and I suspect that the PD's office is pretty low down there on the totem pole.
Well, we got it. We got strong support in our legislature for giving more money, and even some of it's on the bipartisan side. Even the conservatives realize that these constitutional requirement, but you've got all these other things that government does, which it largely go unnoticed. The only time you notice the things is when it's not done.
Yeah, of course.
That's the only time you notice it. You take everything for granted. Mm-hmm. That happens, and people don't understand. I say government affects your life every single day.
Absolutely.
Government is impacting your life.
I do try to have that conversation with people. Yeah, you may hate politics, but where your kid goes to school, how the school is, where your roads are, how much traffic there is, it's all politics. Everything that you do is some politician has put their stamp on it, pro or against.
Well, did you eat at a restaurant today, Andy?
Actually, yes, I did today.
Okay, well, government had an impact on
Absolutely.
That. They impacted the food inspection for the food that got to you,
zoning,
how it was processed. They impacted the restaurant is under an inspection regime to keep you safe. Mm-hmm. And we've learned that that's the necessary part, because if we pulled out the USDA inspectors and we didn't inspect any food at ports of entry and in slaughterhouses, the restaurants are inspected to make sure that they follow proper sanitation and all that. So government have impacted you today.
I completely understand
of course,
and agree.
I'm sure you drove on a street today that government impacted that. I'm sure you breathed air today. The Clean Air Act has impacted that. I'm sure that the nation's security was impacted by government. It wasn't by some miracle divine intervention that the nation is somewhat secure. I mean, go on and on. The government impacts your life. If you got a kid that's in school, the government is impacting that. And, you know, the police are a service of government. I mean, the fire department is a service of government. The animal control is a service of government. The pothole repair, the sanitation, the water delivery. I mean, we can just spend days and days talking about what government does, but people take it for granted because the things happen. It's only when that they don't happen that all of a sudden they notice that there's something wrong, and then they're mad at government.
Yeah, I get that too. All right, well, then the article that we're going to cover next is from NPR, and the Farm Bill Compromise reached with SNAP changes out, industrial hemp in. What is hemp? I've heard this term my entire life, and all I know is that you can make like t-shirts or rope out of it or something like that.
Yeah, I'm going to be over my head on this one as well, but I know that we've got listeners out there that can help us.
Hank.
The $867 billion farm bill is apparently going to pass. The bill must pass both the House and Senate, but it appears to have now cleared the hurdles of all the things that were blocking it. And the big thing for our folks were people were worried about the food stamp changes, and I'm not clear exactly what has emerged on the food stamps.
Right. But does this change? So our listener there in Nebraska, he was like, it was a big deal about how this bill affects, I guess, felons and so forth too. Do you know how that changes?
I'm not clear. I know there's a stricter work requirement being imposed. The what's it really in style right now is to put more work requirements, drug testing on people who receive any type of public assistance. So I think there's a stricter work requirement. For example, during the recession, the work requirement for people to receive food stamps was waived. The states were given a waiver by the federal government that you could lift the work requirement because there were very few jobs for people to get. Well, then as the economy has improved, those states have been imposing the work requirement again, but they didn't just impose what existed previously. Like the previous work requirement was for those 55 and under. Now they've raised the age in my state we managed to stop it, but they've raised the age to 50, and then they reduced the age of having a minor child at home that you would be exempt from the work requirement. And then drug testing could become very popular in the South. You know, states like Alabama and North Carolina, they're trying to make it almost impossible to get these benefits. But I think that the biggest change is the work requirement. But I'm not clear on what they did on the felons if they enlarged the.
I'll share this with you towards the about midway through it. It says because the stricter work requirements are gone from the final bill, House Democrats are largely poised to vote for its passage.
So, well, that means we'll probably be something similar to what the work requirements we already have, which I think federally are like at 55. You have to have a disability. If you're under 55 to be exempt from job training or work requirement, if you're going to receive SNAP or what we used to call food stamps. So anybody can get an exemption for being having a disability or being over 55 or having minor children. And like I say, they wanted to reduce the age of the minor child to 16 from, I think it was 18 if you had a minor at home, but I think an 18, 17 year old is okay to be self-supervised, but how much lower do you take the age where a kid needs some supervision? I don't know. I'm not a parent, but at some point teenagers need supervision.
Certainly. Certainly. Certainly.
Well, you're closer to that. You've got one like 11 years old. When will you guys be comfortable leaving him without supervision?
I think legally he is allowed to be home alone for a brief period of time. He can self-supervise, but just a short period of time. And then I think maybe 12, he could be on his own. I don't want to say indefinitely, but for large stretches of time, so to speak. I mean, you know, you could run to the grocery store now, be gone for, let's say, an hour, half hour, something like that, without a worry. Even though in this modern era, everyone's going to be like, oh, you left your kid home alone for 30 minutes without any supervision? Did he die? No, he didn't die. Good grief, man. What do you think? You left the house and all the air got sucked out? Jesus. We've really... There...
No, but a sexual predator could have broken in.
Yes, because they were like watching every house and they saw the parents leave and they were like, kids are home alone here. And hey, go watch that movie if you want to see how kids can be devious and fight back against the robbers and whatnot. We have become, as the Free Range Kids blog covers, we have some seriously... like Yenta kind of people in our societies that are butting their nose into your business. Like, do you remember when you were a kid, Larry, that your mom would take you to the grocery store and she's like, now just wait here, little Larry. I'm going to be in there for 5 minutes. She left the car running. She left the AC on. You probably had a hand crank on the front of your car, so there was no AC. But she just ran in, grabbed some stuff, came back out, and everything was fine. I can't do that now.
Well, I was going to tell you that just to get the story in perspective. Now, when I was a kid, the cars I rode in to the grocery store did not have air conditioning. In those days, I mean, air conditioning was available to wealthy people, but we weren't in that class. So I rode in cars that were made in the 50s, and then in the 60s that didn't have air conditioning, and then. When I went into a foster care home, they had an old pickup truck that had a cab for two. You could put a third person. They had those, what they call those solid console seats.
Okay.
You could put a third person, but we would be put in the back of the pickup. And sometimes it was on the cold side and you'd be riding for a long ways on what they would lock you up for doing that today. That'd be child abuse.
Absolutely.
But we rode in the back of pickup trucks and we rode it back when it was hot and when it was cold. And, but yes, we did wait. Your point was we waited in the car. And yes, that's exactly what we did. And no one thought anything of it. There was no thought of a predator lurking. You were told to behave yourself. You'd wait in the hot car and they did their shopping and they came back out and that was just the way it was. You didn't think anything of it.
Right. Right. All right. Well, then from the Marshall Project, here's a guy that spent a whole lot of time in prison and ultimately got released. His case was overturned, and he was a pretty prominent guy in the community prior to. But the article goes over how the media on the outside really misportrays the facts. You know, effectively saying, you know, hey, such and such was accused of, and they really paint you as being this like demon person upon your entrance into the criminal justice system. And this guy was trying. Time and time and time and time to gain any traction of to telling his story, and they just continually shut it down. Well, good. And you know, the guy says, I was apathetic to criminal justice coverage prior to being convicted of second degree murder in 1990 and sentenced to life in prison without parole. And that has got to be, I don't know, some really high number of our population has that mindset. I don't know. Is it 80% of the people are just like, I don't know. I've never had to deal with the criminal justice system, so I would prefer that I don't, which probably isn't a bad idea. But that really is unempathetic to the people that do end up on it and possibly are there for the wrong reasons.
Well, it's I say this regularly. You have no reason to know anything to the contrary. You get an indoctrination when you're growing up in this country about our system, what all the process protections we have, and everybody gets a fine attorney, and you're presumed innocent. And it's difficult for you as a law-abiding person growing up, hearing that for decades, to imagine that our system could be as fallible as it is. Therefore, it's difficult for you to comprehend because you always thought that the cops were overworked, short-staffed, and that the lawyers on the defense side made all the money and played the games and worked the system to the advantage of the hoodlum. And so it's hard to be sympathetic to that. So when they put a person in handcuffs and walk them out of courtroom after they've been either pled guilty or they've been convicted by a jury, when's the last time? Let's name some names here. Let's say, does the name Rod Blagojevich ring a bell to you?
Yes, I do know who Rob Blagojevich, mayor of Chicago.
He was the
governor? Mayor?
Governor of Illinois.
Okay, right.
Okay, well, When's the last time you've heard his name?
Roughly when he got convicted.
Yes, they marched him away to prison. Now, he was a high-profile governor who was going to he was taking bids to replace Senator Obama's resignations. Okay, so but for the last 10 years, you've never heard of his name. Okay, then let's look at in Pennsylvania with Sandusky. When's the last time you've heard Sandusky's name come up?
Actually, you know, because of the podcast, I do hear it come up fairly regularly. But no, you know, of course.
But on the regular, correct. In the regular news media, what have you heard? What have you heard? Well, you know, when have you heard? Now, we did hear Bill Cosby's name yesterday because his request for an appeal bond was denied.
Oh, okay.
So he got a brief blurb yesterday. My point is that once these people are carted off, they're forgotten. And so what happened to this young man was exactly what happens to everybody else.
Yeah. You just forgot about out of sight, out of mind.
It bothered him that he was forgotten, but he forgot that he forgot everybody when they were carted off prior to him being carted off.
That's true.
See what I'm saying? He forgot that he forgot everybody. And what we try to do is to try to make sure that people are not forgotten. And we talk about the people who don't have a voice. We do, and the organizations that advocate along the lines of NARSL and others, we advocate for those who are forgotten. He was forgotten, and nobody cared.
For
20 years.
Yeah, I would say that I had a similar point of view, though, until I ended up there.
Absolutely. I think we all did.
So then what is the channel of, I mean, I don't think public education, here's how you manage your checkbook, also be considered of people going to prison. I don't think that is necessarily going to gain any traction of some sort of public awareness campaign.
I don't know. I mean, he spent 27 years and was released in 2016 when his sentence was commuted by that liberal do-good Governor John Bel Edwards in Louisiana. But he spent 27 years in prison, and he was forgotten.
That's a really long. I mean, the entire world would change in 27 years too.
Absolutely.
Forget these little decade long sentences. 27 is a long effing time to be locked up.
I don't know what it would take to change American perception. I suppose as more and more people were wrongly convicted or released, it might heighten the awareness, but you have the other side constantly screaming that there's too many people getting away and that the system's broken and that the people getting off. I don't know that even the we've had a deluge of people. We've had how many people that were on death row that have been that they've found out physically could not have committed the crime?
Yeah, sure.
That the scientific evidence has shown that they could not have done what they were convicted of doing.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, I don't want to say it again, but we're not really we're not a compassionate group of people that we Americans.
Why the hell don't you leave?
I know. Well,
why don't you leave? Yes.
Well, so we will set up FYP Studios middle of Atlantic Ocean, and I'll be on a sailboat, and I'll use a satellite phone, and we'll record the podcast from there, and I'll just have my own sovereign territory called Andy's Boat.
If you can find a country that's better than this one, then you should just leave and quit griping.
I'm not really sure that. I know you're being tongue in cheek. I just don't know that really exists. I do still think that the U.S. is probably the best country on the planet.
In some regards.
Yeah, no. Yeah, but I think taken as a whole, I would just take it as like the American system overall is probably better. It's just I don't know. But again, I have a sample size of one. I haven't been there.
Yeah. I was going to say, in some regards, I think in some regards we measure up lacking. But if you look at where people want to go to, this is a country where a lot of people want to come. There are other countries where people want to go as well, but this is a country where people want to come. And I think the way it was put to me most frequently when I was doing property management was that the opportunity.
Right.
There is a lot of opportunity in America, and you're not relegated to the caste that you're born in here.
Definitely.
I am the law and order candidate.
All right. Well, from the Washington Post, is the GOP the law and order party? Not so much. Well, there's a guy named, what's his name? This guy is named Epstein. What's his first name? I don't even know his first name. Jeffrey Epstein.
I think it's Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Epstein is a multi-billionaire, and he was allegedly molesting and sexually abusing dozens of underage girls, some still in braces, which I'm not really sure how that's relevant because you could be wearing braces when you're 30. And one 15-year-old victim said she was recruited to be a sex slave out of the Mar-a-Lago locker room. Hint, 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 hint. I wonder where that is. But so here's a guy that is accused of a bazillion different things. And he is a heavy, heavy, heavy donator to he was actually a Democrat donor. But he hired a few well-connected Republican lawyers. So he's obviously out of Florida for Mar-a-Lago. And he got one of the most lenient deals for a serial child sex offender in history, according to the Miami Herald. So, and Florida is pretty much Republican-controlled all the way through, I believe. Their farm person, the Department of Farming, whatever it would be called. That one has just been flipped to a Democrat seat. Otherwise, I think they're red all the way through.
So, what is your point?
Well, if Team Red is all pro law and order, then why was this guy able to kind of sort of buy his way out of having 300 years in prison?
Well, now, you know, being on the defense side, I'm going to take a slightly different view. Going to take the view that perhaps they didn't have a strong case.
Yeah, I know.
Perhaps there is. Well, there's no perhaps. There is double justice. There is separate standards of justice for the haves and the have-nots. But this Jeffrey Epstein apparently did get what appears to be a very good deal. Currently, the U.S. Secretary of Labor was apparently the prosecutor at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have that correct?
Let me see. Labor. Yeah. So, Alexander Acosta, now Trump's Secretary of Labor, a position with oversight over international child labor laws and human trafficking.
Was the U.S. Attorney
mm-hmm.
that apparently struck the deal with Epstein. So I don't know. I don't know enough about it. But
of course.
I always take the position that if they get a good deal, it could just easily be they had a crappy case. It could be also that but it says the undisputed facts in this case prove that rather than forthrightly discharge its obligations, numerous child sex, the government chose to enter a secret deal with the man who had victimized them. That's what a professor from the University of Utah asserts about this deal. Did you see that in the paragraph there?
I did.
Yeah. So
it seems like he's a pretty poopy person, and because he has a gazillion dollars and very politically connected, that he was able to whittle his way out of having some horrendous amount of time, whereas Joe Schmo is not able to do it. And I guess the point of the article is that the Republicans are running around saying that they're the law and order candidates and they're all about some law and order and funding big, the law enforcement apparatus, as you call it. But he got a pretty sweet deal.
Well, Epstein's attorney was Alan Dershowitz, and most everybody listening to this podcast probably heard the name. He's a very prominent Harvard attorney, and he said that we out-lawyered him as how we got the deal, and then the quote says, "I guess it depends on how you define lawyering."
Right, but doesn't that? I mean, God, why it doesn't seem fair that it shouldn't matter your economic status necessarily on how good or bad a defense you get. It doesn't seem like there should be that much of a disparity between the two.
Well, and if you're willing to pay those taxes, Andy, I think we can match you on that. But how many people are willing to pay the taxes to hire Alan Dershowitz's for everybody?
Right. I know that we're in a capitalistic society, and you can buy a shitty mechanic for your car, and you can buy an awesome mechanic for your car, and you're going to get the different results. But I can't, like, the 5-star rating on a $10,000 car is equal to a 5-star rating on a Lexus. Like, those two things are sort of equivalent, not that big of a difference. But in this case, I mean, you are talking about a significant difference in how your future life progresses because of how much money you have.
And the resources that attorneys have, it's not people just think of the attorney fee itself. And it's also the investigative resources that are available to an attorney, to a
right.
team, a defense yep. team. We're not living in the 1840s any longer, where the there was no forensics in a crime. It was an eyewitness that saw it, or circumstantial evidence. We don't live in those days anymore. We live in a very highly, highly expensive world where there are experts for everything.
Sure.
Forensics evidence rules the day. And so it's not only that you need Dershowitz or someone of his caliber, you need a bankroll to look at the forensics evidence. When they do an internet case, I mean, they have tons of forensics data that these computer gurus charge tons of money to analyze for you.
Absolutely.
We're people that want to be back in the good old days. Sorry, we're not going to be back in the 1850s anymore.
What?
You can't just appoint a lawyer and say, Mr. Smith, well, you kind of take on Andy's case and do the best you can with it. Well, that's not the world we're in anymore. The body of evidence that's facing the defense attorney is going to require experts in most cases, that there's going to be some expertise involved that the attorney is going to need to hire out. And that's sorely lacking in our public defense systems. And the people who hate taxes are not ready to pony up any more taxes. And I've even had the conversation with people on our side. I said, well, okay, you keep saying that you find it appalling that we don't have the resources. Are you willing to pay? No! And I say, well, then where are we going to find the funding to do what you say you believe that you would want to have done? And they said, well, we cut somewhere else. And I said, well, then let's make a list of the cuts. And of course, when you got on the list of cuts, you always get a very narrow list of cuts of what people are willing to cut.
Yeah.
And what they're willing to cut won't do what needs to be done. You know, they'll come up with a list of things, and usually it's foreign aid, or it's the programs to help the most neediest and vulnerable they're willing to cut. They're willing to cut food stamps. They're willing to cut aid to dependent, well, they don't call it that anymore, TANF, but the program that helps people with minor children that are struggling. They want to cut women, infants, and children, the WIC program. They're willing to cut things like that.
Yep.
But all those combined don't, that's not where the deficit is. You know, that's right. Not where the mismatch is spending, but you can't find the things to cut. And of course, when we're talking about energy defense, we're largely talking about state or local funded. The federal system is fairly well taken care of. I'll give the feds credit for that. The federal public defender system is way better funded than any state system I'm aware of.
Then we can come back and cover the next article as soon as I freaking find it. Ah, here we go. Oh, yeah, this is a fun one. We should totally... Here, I was thinking about this today. If why is it that we don't let people join the military until they're 18, but they can't drink until they're 21? However, we will turn that all upside down and go, well, hey, you shouldn't have committed an adult crime when you're 15 years old, and we're going to put you in the big house with the big dogs. But part of the criminal justice reform bill, I think this is in the First Step Act, that minors will not be in adult prisons unless it's something like, you know, it's a small rural community and you've got to, you don't have the resources until you can move them along to someplace that would have a juvie kind of holding facility. But why are we so hell-bent on locking up 15-year-olds and younger, whatever, with the adult people?
I wish I had an answer. I find it, thankfully, we don't do it in my state, but it's rampant across this country, and even in states that you would expect to know better do this. I don't know why. I think when we had the crime wave of in the 90s, there was a lot of overreach there was a wave of delinquent kids, and even they were talking about it here. We just didn't go to quite the extreme that other states did. But it makes us feel good to say, if you're old enough to do the time, crime, you're old enough to do the time. And it's just such a silly argument, because that brain is not developed. Yes, they can.
Well, the part of the argument that I was making at that point then is then we probably shouldn't let them join the military at 18 because their brain isn't developed.
Well, that's a different story for a different day. But there used to be an exception in the drinking. If you were in the military, you drink, because I think that's been eradicated now. But
long ago,
but there's why that we do such a double take, because the prosecutors that will hand out 20, 30 years to someone who victimizes a child will turn around and give a child a horrendous sentence as well in adult court. And yet they say it's all for the kids. You know, we're sending these bad guys away for a long period of time for the kids, and then they send a kid away for a long period of time and even to an adult jail. I don't get it. I'm thankful that this is going to survive, that there's going to be some improvement in the First Step Act. Hopefully this trickles down through the states and through to, this results in some change. It saddens me that we do this in this country, and hopefully this is the first step towards eradicating that practice. Also, our practice of chaining women when they're having a baby in prison. You know, to me, I can't imagine we would do that, but we do.
Right. And so just to be clear, so this article comes from the Marshall Project, and the Criminal Justice Reform Bill You've Never Heard Of is the title of it. And the Senate has quietly passed a juvenile justice legislation that would ban states from holding children in adult jails, and it has gone to the president's desk for signature. This is not related to the First Step Act, which we don't have anything in the show notes to cover about it. However, I think it was just this week that McConnell decided to put it on the Senate floor for a vote.
I'd heard that. I thought I had dropped in an article, but yes, this is the, as you say, the bill we haven't heard of, and it is a first step towards major juvenile justice reform, because there's unthinkable practices happening. I don't know why you would need a law. I don't understand why you need a law not to chain a woman up. I don't understand why you need a law to tell you not to put a 12-year-old with a bunch of adults. I don't know why you would need
you
a law
God.
To tell you, you know better than to do that. You know that the 12-year-old is irritating the hell out of you, and they might have done something that was quite horrendous, but they are still just 12 years old. No matter how you look at it, they're only 12 years old. And I don't know why you need a law to force you to do what you know internally is the right thing to do, which is not to put these kids in adult courts and adult prisons.
But don't you think it is, I mean, it is the will of the people, and we are like, well, that 12-year-old did these terrible things, then they are acting like an adult, and they should be treated in the most harsh manner possible. They are a corrupt entity, and they are never going to be rehabilitated, and we should just bury them under the jail and be done with it.
Well,
I mean, like the mentality of our society seems to be that.
Well, they are a corrupt entity. They are their defective unit, absolutely. But they're only 12, 13, 14 years old. They may not be a defective unit if we work on salvaging the unit, particularly at that age. And all the evidence shows to the contrary, that they're most likely to be amenable to rehabilitation. Very few adolescents are not amenable at all to rehabilitation.
Of course.
That's my understanding of it. Now, we welcome somebody to come on with expertise that doesn't agree with that. But my understanding is the overwhelming number of adolescents change by just age progression and by therapeutic intervention and therapeutic communities. An adult prison is not a therapeutic community.
No, that is definitely the antithesis of therapeutic community. It is a really crappy environment, overall.
I mean,
for all people.
I mean, we do a better job here. I frequently quote Cody Posey, which the name nobody remembers, but they do remember the name Sam Donaldson. And Cody Posey was 14 years old when he killed his parents on the Donaldson Ranch here in New Mexico. And Cody Posey could not be tried in adult court, and all he did was kill his family. But our laws are tough enough that it was not possible to put that child in adult court. He was released when he was 21 years of old age. And as far as I know, he's not engaged in any criminality since then. He was rehabilitated.
Did the Menendez brothers get, that was like in the 80s or 90s where the two brothers killed their parents. Did they get tried as adults?
I remember the case, how that case was disposed of, but Posey was not able to be put in adult. They tried, but they failed because the standard of putting a kid in adult court here is pretty high, particularly at that age. It gets a little easier when they get 17. But at 14, it's very difficult to put a 14-year-old in adult court, as it should be.
Hey, so I'm going to – Laura's in the chat with me, and she says, my judge sent me to AA when I was 12, in with a bunch of recovering adults. Some shit happened, let me tell you. Can you imagine being in AA when you're 12 with a bunch of 40-year-old whatever other recovering alcoholics?
I wonder if there was any perving going on in there.
I got to think that there was some, there was probably some flirtatious activity, if not more so than flirtatious activity.
No. Well, nobody knows what perving is, I'm sure.
No, probably not. Well, then let's move over to the penultimate article, because we have the feature event here coming up in a second. And it's from Psychology Today, written by Dr. Karen Franklin. And why are all these men downloading child pornography? It's a really long article. And I find it kind of interesting that there's this heavy analysis going through that because of the internet. I hate that everything about the internet is like it's bad, but that it's so easy to download all of the porn. And maybe when you start, you're watching something very just kind of normal, if you want to, you know, if we can come up with what normal is. And then you, like, I guess you get tired of normal, so you move something a little bit more extreme. You move to further extreme, and you get into, I mean, she even says in the article about moving into bestiality and other BDSM kind of topics. And eventually, somebody ends up having the kiddie porn stuff because not necessarily like you're into it, but it is that something unique and just different that it then continues to excite the chemicals in your brain. But there's a difference between a pedophile and someone that is curious, I guess. And we keep convicting these people of these horrendous sentences for some level of curiosity. I think that the way that she described it was like someone that is actually like a pedophile would have them organized and categorized, and someone that just happens to be a porn aficionado, it's just part of the collection, not actually something that would be coveted, I guess you could say. It's just an interesting article on how different areas of your brain start shrinking if you are a relentless porn watcher, and the dopamine levels start changing and all that. Just an interesting article. Well, not sure what impact it would have in any regard for our case.
It's a very long read, but I did a Larry read because it was so long. But the aggregating 9 studies on reoffense using meta-analytic methods, that's a subheader there. Prominent pedophilia researcher, yeah, Michael Cito and colleagues found on average a man who has been caught with child porn has a 3.4% chance of committing another non-contact offense, and that's pretty low compared to regular recidivism. That's 9 studies, that's not one. And then the risk, right, he will actually molest a child is even lower, at around 2%, which is fairly low. I mean, I know that I tell people the reason why this is such a horrible example. If I put 100 bullets in a
yes,
auto fire gun, and I tell you only 2 of them lives, I bet you wouldn't let me shoot it at you. So
I'm with you. I'm with you on your analogy there of the numbers, like the risk factor there.
So if I let you run out 100 yards, I tell you now there's only 2 bullets in here. It's gonna be live rounds. I bet you wouldn't tell me to open fire. But the 2% is a pretty low rate. So I think we can extrapolate from the 9 studies that people looking at porn do not in huge numbers transition to become child molesters. I think we can say that.
Sure. You could also say that they don't transition to become more child porn consumers.
So
after they're outed is probably the key point there. It seems like for a first-time person, provided they're not like the distributor or the creator of it, you could give them something along the lines of a community service, a significant slap on the wrist, very, you know, sternly or something, and you would possibly then see no further activity.
I would tend to agree with that. I think our criminal justice system could do a lot of slapping on the wrist and probably never see these people again. When I say slapping on the wrist, I mean in terms of comparing it to our horrendous prison sentences. You can punish someone pretty severely. Give an example for a DWI, driving while intoxicated. That's a horrendous punishment you get with a first offender program. You don't do a single hour in jail except for the time that it takes you to be booked through the process. But you have to be...
Even though you could potentially mow down and kill a family in that state.
Right. But you to do the first offender program, which is what you're going to get on your first guilty plea, you're going to have an ignition interlock for a year.
Right.
You're going to have to attend a screening to see if you have a drinking problem. You're going to have to sit through a victim impact panel. You're going to have to be on probation until you get supervised probation until you get those things done, and then it can be converted to unsupervised probation. You're going to have a series of court costs for all those screenings and all those fines and stuff. So you're going to have hundreds of dollars for that. You're going to have attorney's fees, the humiliation of having your arrest published in the newspaper. It is a horrendous amount of punishment that goes with a first-time DWI. You don't do a single day in jail.
Right.
But that's enough to where the overwhelming number of people don't do a second one. Now, people do second and subsequent DWIs. I'm not saying that nobody ever does, but I'm talking about in the totality of the arrest universe, that is enough of a deterrent. Then what you do with the subsequent offenders, you have to figure out different approaches. Just putting them in jail for a year to cool out their jets, that doesn't work either. But that's what we tend to do. We tend to say, well, you had the first offender program. You had a chance to get some help. You didn't get any. And by golly, this time around, we need to teach you a lesson you won't soon forget. Well, all you do is teach yourself a lesson because you spend a whole bunch of money incarcerating them. You make sure they don't have a job when they come out. And they come out in a worse condition being around real offenders because these might be high-functioning people who have normal jobs and good-paying jobs, paying taxes. Right. And they come out less functional and you have a more damaged unit than what you had because they weren't in a therapeutic community while they were incarcerated. So you actually taught yourself a lesson. You've converted a person from a tax-paying unit to a tax-receiving unit because they may have to go on different types of aid. And they end up in that cycle, the judicial system going through arrest and rearrest and rearrest. Maybe we need to rethink how we deal with offenders in general. Maybe the therapeutic community may need to be brought back into the picture more than what it is today.
Heresy. The things you're saying are heresy.
That's right. It's a bunch of liberal hooey is what it is.
Interesting article, long read. The only thing that I'm skeptical about, and you know, this, like, so Roberto Luongo is the guy that wrote the like the first thing about the recidivism rate that came out in Psychology Today. So I don't know. I don't want to condemn them forever for something that was written in the 80s and throw everything they do under the bus.
Oh, now we're off to the main event.
Well, this I'm definitely going to need some help from you on this one. But for the dumb people in the audience like myself, this is a woman. This is out of Ohio. This is a case that was filed where she's going to be listed as a sexual predator. And it is, I guess, in the way that I would describe it is, so she did something in the past and she's going to carry this label that she then has to carry it forever. And there's no due process in her carrying it effectively forever. And I definitely see that as a problem. Like, you're judged by your worst day in life and you're going to carry that moniker forever. Am I close?
You've done a very fine job of saying
with my this stupid up. People talk.
So, this for purposes of the litigation, this was a Jane Doe. She pleaded guilty to unlawful sexual contact with a minor in Ohio in 2006. And she was sentenced to 1 year of confinement and 5 years of supervision. And the process in Ohio at that time allowed for the sentencing court to set the level of registration that they could categorize. And there was one category called sexually violent predator. And she was categorized right. That way. A sexual predator. Sexual predator. And there was no violence there, but she was a sexual predator by designation of the court. And the issue that she raised was that designation cannot be removed because in 2003, the law had changed in Ohio that previously allowed for anybody who was deemed a sexual predator to go back and petition for a redesignation. But the Ohio General Assembly decided that it was a one-time determination. You know, it costs money to have hearings and to give people second, third, fourth, and fifth chances. So for whatever the reasons were, they decided in 2003 that they would do away with the opportunity to come back and revisit the issue. So Ms. Doe felt like that was a violation of due process because she has that predator, excuse me, once
right,
again.
Right, not violent. SVP.
I'm so used to that. It is predator, but it's not violent predator. She has that sexual predator designation. And she wanted the federal court. She took her case to federal court. And people do that because the process provides for a compensation on the backside, and these cases can drag on for a long time. And so the prevailing party can win. And, of course, in hindsight, the question you ask is, wonder why she didn't take it to state court. Well, I know that one of the considerations would have been the fee award that it would not have come with it in state court. But the state courts have been fairly generous in Ohio. They've had two major decisions after Ohio ramped up their registration requirements in 07. Ohio was the first state to come into compliance, substantially compliant with the federal guidelines that they passed in 06 in the Adam Walsh Act. Ohio wanted to get the bonus money for early implementation, and they were the first state to be pronounced substantially compliant in 2007. And that went away from the risk-based system where the judge imposed a finding of which designation offender was categorized, and it put it into based on your offense of conviction. And the Ohio courts were very generous on that. In the case of Bodike, they said that you couldn't do that. It was separation of powers. And then they came back shortly later in the case of Williams and said, and you can't do it ex post facto either. So the people who were under the old system largely got restored to what they had under the old system. But the new system, the 2007 version, is offense-based only. And she said that that's not fair. I'm entitled to not be a predator. And the district court, the federal district judge, agreed with her and said, yes, you're entitled to process. But when she took it up on appeal, the Court of Appeals, which is the next step below the U.S. Supreme Court, that court said, nope, you don't have that. And that would be the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. They said, no, you don't have such a right to due process that your state lawmakers have decided that they don't want to revisit the issue time and time again. And that's their prerogative to do that. And us sitting here with black robes, we don't get to decide what would be a better public policy for your state. You had a due process. You had an opportunity to show that you won. And the fact they don't wish you to come back again and again and again, that's their prerogative. That's essentially, in a nutshell, what they said in this opinion is that it's the purview of the legislature to do what they did. And who are we to second guess them?
But so, like people where they're sentenced to life and then they get set off, and they get set off by X number of years, seems like sort of a due process-ish kind of thing. Why would you be labeled as a thing and then never, ever be able to revisit it? I don't care if the lawmakers said that they didn't want to do it, but why wouldn't you have some way, like, even though they didn't establish some sort of framework for you to have an appeal process, why can't you blaze a trail and do it yourself?
Well, the court didn't say that such a process couldn't exist. They just said it's not. You don't want, now, Andy, being a good, you don't want people who have black robes sitting high up in a building in the 14th floor of a federal courthouse out of state deciding that the citizens of Ohio have to spend their money a particular way, and imposing that will on the people of Ohio to provide a process that the citizens decided that they did not want to provide. The court is saying that's not for us to tell the state of Ohio how to spend its money. They've given her a due process. When she had her conviction, she had the opportunity to argue that she wasn't a predator. She had a full hearing, and she was adjudicated a predator. And therefore, she's a predator until the state decides they want to change that. And that was her due process. What entitles a judge to require a state? Now of course, I'm just being a devil's advocate.
I know.
But what entitles a judge to spend the citizens' money to force them to do something unless it was a constitutional violation? And they're saying there is no constitutional violation because you had due process. There's nowhere in the Constitution that says you have to have continuing due process over and over again. You don't get to go back and argue your conviction time and time and time again. You get the due process of a fair trial once. And if it's a fair trial, it's a fair trial.
The only mechanism that she would then have is to like actually make an amendment change or something, a law change, an amendment to a law to allow some sort of rehearing every X number of years or something like that, right?
That is correct. The court said that it's a decision for the Ohio Assembly to decide if they want people that are having to wear this label for their life and report in every 90 days for life. If they want to take that away, they can do that. But they have a category under their tier three already, where they have essentially the same obligations. You know, if you're Ohio, you can be in one of three tiers, and she's pre-AWA, so the people. She's under the old system, which gave her that obligation under their old pre-AWA, what they call Megan's Law in Ohio. But the But the AWA people in Ohio, they have to report every 9 days for the rest of their life, and they can't do anything about it.
And the
court said that that's just fine if that's what they want the regulatory system to be.
But so we talk a lot trying to compare, like, so the registry is just a civil regulatory scheme. Okay, great. But there's nothing else like this with that much impact over your life unless you...
She didn't argue that in this case, though. She just argued it was a due process. She didn't argue the registry was punitive. I didn't see anywhere in this opinion where that was an issue before the court.
I mean, the reason why you would try and change any sort of designation like that would be because of the impact that it's having on her life. I'm putting my thoughts in her brain, but...
Right, but you have to litigate the issue below before the Court of Appeals can take it up. If you're just simply arguing that there's no due process, if her case had been that the registry was punitive, they would be deciding that. They didn't decide that the registry was punitive or not punitive. They decided that she was not entitled to due process.
Do you think that she should have argued about the devastation of being on the registry, especially with that extra fund marker on her profile, that it is?
I think she probably should have in hindsight.
And do you think that that's then lack of an attorney's foresight in seeing this in the way to argue it and develop the case?
Possibly, but gee, I'd have to have a whole lot more information. I'd have to have the pleadings and I'd have to go a whole lot deeper in this. But she didn't argue that the registry was.
That's interesting. It seems like that would be. Because, I mean, otherwise, like, if you have a designation that no one ever sees or really cares about, if it were just law enforcement only that had your photo in this book with a Polaroid picture of yourself, I kind of don't think most of our people, like, I wouldn't care. I would care less if it were just isolated down in that way.
Well, I'm just going on when you look on the opinion itself, and you look at the page 4 procedural history, it says Doe filed this 42 United States Code 1983 action against Ohio Attorney General, the Superintendent of Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, and the Sheriff of Hamilton County, seeking a declaration that Ohio revised code blah, blah, blah is unconstitutional because it prevents her from obtaining a hearing to demonstrate that she is no longer likely to engage in the future in one or more sexually oriented offenses, thus violating her procedural and substantive due process under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. The Constitution. Doe also seeks a order that a hearing be scheduled in the sentencing court to determine whether she's currently dangerous. That's the essence of her complaint. There's nothing saying that the registry is
punitive bizarre.
That I see.
And I don't know. So this was filed in 06. So she may not have, no, I'm sorry. In 12, she filed it. So the stuff has been tacked on since 06 of being like the registry's impact. It's interesting that she wouldn't have brought that up.
Well, she just got off supervision, I'm guessing, because it said she got a year in custody and then 5 years probation. So when you add 6 to 6, you're at 12. So she probably rode out the storm and then she filed this when she got off paper. Because not wanting to rock the boat, knowing that they would try to violate her and lock her up. Of course, I know that in some states, the probation system is pure as the wind-driven snow, and they would never do that. But I don't hold that hope that that's a universal thing. But probably in your jurisdiction, they're pure wind-driven. but she had a very narrowly focused case. Now, in hindsight, with our looking backwards, we could say perhaps maybe she should have brought in more issues that the registry was punitive, but she didn't. She was complaining about due process, procedural and substantive, which I'm very inadequate in explaining the difference between the two, so I won't even try.
So in closing, what should we title this segment, this episode?
Well, the people who want strict constructionists and conservative judges and who are not interventionists and not legislating from the bench, they should be very, very happy with this ruling. Just like the people in Nebraska when the state court decided to take a different direction than the federal court. You had an activist federal court in Nebraska, and in this case, you've got a court that's taking a hands-off attitude, and they're deferring to the states to do what they think is best for their citizens. And if you are of the conservative persuasion, then this ruling should make you extremely happy, because this is what a conservative jurist would come up with.
So states' rights rule the day, or conservative judges affirm states' rights?
Well, I think states' rights
All
rules the
right
day,
then.
because we get attacked for saying conservative. And said, I don't know if this 3-judge panel. I don't know what who appointed them, what the ideology is. But I'm saying, as a general rule, this would be something that a conservative would want. The judges were White, Donald, and Larson. Now, I don't know anything about White, Donald, or Larson of the three, but you would not want a federal judge telling the state, you have to spend a whole bunch of money to do something that you've chosen more than a decade ago that you don't want to do. That's inconsistent with conservative doctrine. You would not want a court coming in forcing the state
Right,
to do
right, right,
that.
right. Separation of powers, right?
Absolutely. And so when states do things you don't agree with, then all of a sudden you look for more, a little more intervention. But these judges, they took a very hands-off conservative viewpoint of letting the state do what they're
The
doing.
other, the only other piece of this, and it's just sort of like a minor footnote, is I just want to highlight that this was filed in 2012, and it took 6 or 7 years for it to actually get to this point.
And point out this, the legal team will not collect any money out of this. So this poor lady, which I assume being a sexual predator, probably doesn't have gobs of money. The legal team was hoping to collect on the backside as a prevailing party. They won't get a dime for the hundreds of hours at whatever cost they spent on this out of pocket. They
Do you
won't
want to
get any of
speculate
this.
how much they
And
would
this is
have,
why
like, in billable hours?
it would be unimaginable for 6 years of litigation going up on appeal. But the Michigan, the Sixth Circuit case, the fee award to the attorneys that the state stipulated to was
Holy
1.8
shit.
million
So I was
dollars.
just going to say,
And,
like, 6 figures, and you're going to turn around and say no.
no, the Doe versus Snyder case was settled for $1.8 million in legal fees awarded to the prevailing
Wow.
parties
But I'm saying for this, I
out
was
of
going to say
Michigan as
something
well.
like in the 6 figures, and you would turn around and say no, 7 figures for this, maybe.
Well, I don't know if it'd be 7 figures, but it'd easily be 6 figures, but they won't get a dime.
Wow. And she's wow, that's a lot of
And
money. Okay.
that's why people are not lining up to do these cases, because this is your risk. You've got 6 years of your firm's hours where you had to pay for that. And if you're a solo practitioner, you can barely do something like Alison Ruttenberg out
Right.
of Colorado when she did the case in district court that's up on appeal in tenth right now. Alison was just a solo practitioner who was doing the best she could and did a very fine job. But if you're a sole practitioner, you're not feeding your family during this time. And if you're in a firm, your partners are asking you, what are you doing here? I mean, this thing has run up. We're now at $162,000 in billable. Where's this case ending? Where's it going? Then when you're at $240,000 of billable hours, and then when the decision like this comes down, if this is a law firm that's carried this, then they're looking at themselves saying, why the hell did we fall for this? It was like, we've got $250,000 invested in this case and we're not going to get a
Wow.
dime.
Interesting. God, it's so expensive. It's just so
And
expensive.
the offender population wonders why that people don't step up.
Yeah,
Well,
no doubt.
this is why.
Wow. Just like administratively, probably won't record next week, possibly won't record after that. So next week will be Christmas. And sorry, guys, go spend time with your family. Don't listen to a podcast about sexual offenses. And depending on how schedules work, people are traveling and all that stuff, we may throw out an episode that would be like leading up right up to New Year's.
We might, and but we love you just the same, even though we don't do one on Christmas.
Absolutely. Hey, Larry, how can people spread the word and share the podcast with all of the people that they know?
Well, it's very, very delicate, but they
It's
can do it
delicate.
by a it's complex, delicate, and we can send people to registrymatters.co. Isn't that one way?
That is definitely one way. That is to visit the website where the episode will be published for all of the world to see.
And then if you have questions or comments and you want to leave something for us to play or possibly answer a question, if it's within our limited powers, you can call us at 747, like the airplane, 227-4477.
I'll also add that you could do you could we could bring you on over Discord too and have a much higher quality connection if you want to do it that way too.
And And you can email us if you want to chat with us. We don't guarantee that we can solve your problem, but we can at least say hi and thank you for the email. And that's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or you can do the thing we really like, and that's support us at patreon.com/registrymatters.
That's not Patreon?
I thought you told me it wasn't Patreon.
It is not Patreon. I'm just picking on somebody. Somebody that doesn't listen to the podcast, even.
The Discord, you can explain. That's all gibberish to me. I see there's something about Discord.
Yeah, Discord is how we record the podcast. It's consider it Skype for gamers, and it's a high quality. Hey, there's a whole community here of us here for the Registry Matters podcast. I'm on here all day. If you wanted to come in and chat, you could join us on Discord, and that would be super duper fun.
How would I find you if I wanted to find you on Discord?
If you clicked on the link that is in the show notes, you would totally find us on Discord. You'll just pop up in here.
Magically, I would just be in your chat room if I did that.
That is pretty much how it's set up. Yeah, it's not very difficult. You don't even have to. You can maintain anonymity out of the whole deal. It's going to ask you to like register your email address, but just click away from it. You don't have to, and you can make any name you want. You can be as vulgar and profane as you want. Can't say that I'm going to respond to you if you do it that way. You don't have to give me your real name by any means. And, but yeah, I mean, I think it would be a great place for us to have a regular ongoing conversation with people and people asking questions or posting links and supporting the podcast inside of the Discord server as well.
And we are,
perhaps I could even convince you to show up there and you could have some sort of dialogue with people there too.
And we are growing, and I might do that one of these days. You know,
yeah.
Didn't you say we're up like 30% in the last couple of weeks or episodes?
Yeah. Call it a month. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Larry, I, as always, very much appreciate it and enjoy the time with you. And I hope you have a wonderful Christmas, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Andy. It's my pleasure. And Merry Christmas to every one of our listeners and supporters. Happy holidays. Whatever you do for holidays, be safe. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.
Absolutely. And great. Have a great night, Larry. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.